You're listening to Rendezvous with the Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell, only on LA Talk Radio.
I am Bobby Jean Bell, and here in the co-pilot seat is
Jim Bell.
And we're delighted that you're joining us today, either on you're watching on Facebook, on the LA Talk Radio Facebook page, and you're seeing this live, or perhaps you're listening on audio at latalkradio.com, or maybe you're catching the podcast down the road. We sure do thank you for giving us a little bit of your time, and we hope that we will entertain you and also provide some good tips about writing.
Right.
Yeah, about writing. We have a special guest tonight. Who's joining us tonight?
Joining us tonight is a very good friend of ours, Joe Harrington.
Yes, and he's just on the screen, but before we do the wonderful intro, I just want to point out that Joe is an author, and we're going to be talking about his books tonight. The first one, Takeo, and then its sequel, Takeo and the Book of Secrets.
The Book of Secrets.
Yeah, we're going to find all about the Book of Secrets.
Let's talk about Joe a little bit.
Sure.
Born and raised a Texan, tonight's guest, Joe Harrington, grew up loving and exploring the boundless wilds of the rugged West Texas Badlands, from Big Bend to the Guadalupes. It's a starkly impressive country of wide open mesas and rugged mountains. It's rich with the history of the Old West and replete with colorful legends. It's a country that naturally gives birth to extraordinary stories, and Joe is a storyteller. Mm-hmm. Please welcome to Rendezvous with a Writer, author, poet, storyteller, a good friend, Mr. Joe Harrington.
Welcome, Joe.
Well, thank you, Bobby Jean and Jim. Appreciate it very much. We go way back.
We go way back. I think to 2009.
I remember doing a show in your store. Uh-huh. I can't remember who we did it with, but I sure remember doing it in your store.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You have been an MC for a number of events of ours.
You were an MC.
We've done things combined with the city of Santa Clarita, and you led the show. We moved from one location to another, and you gave a blessing and were the MC on that move.
Well, and you installed the floor.
What else can we say?
You've been with us from the ground up, Joe.
Yes.
You wanted to share?
I just want to read one other little thing before we get into the first question we asked, Joe. And this is just a couple of words, you know, from the foreword by Kevin Rafferty on the Secrets book. Mm-hmm. You know, Kevin, for those of you who don't know, is the former director of Walt Disney Engineering. I think he retired last year. And he was with Imagineering almost as long as Joe has been there. And obviously quite a guy. But what he said, this is the first couple of sentences, Joe Harrington, master storyteller, and himself a man of honor and integrity, tells an extraordinary tale and teaches about life and how to best live it. Okay. Joe is a storyteller. You've been telling stories around the campfire, on stage, and in print. Joe, how did you get started?
I'm sorry, was that a question?
You've been telling stories around a campfire and on stage and in print for quite a while. How did you get started, Joe, in telling stories?
How did I get started? Well, I'd have to say that I grew up at the feet of storytellers. My grandfather and uncles just talked in stories. And as a child, we just thought everybody did that. It was fascinating to us. Of course, we didn't have television those days. We did have radio, but we didn't have television. In fact, I never saw television until, I guess I was out of elementary school. But we would sit around in the evenings when we finished work, and he worked us, my grandfather and my uncles worked us pretty hard. Not that my father didn't, but my father wasn't so much of a storyteller as they are, or they were. And we would sit around, I would sit there, my cousins, and listen to their stories. And there would be stories about their childhood, stories that they, about the adventures of their growing up. And boy, they were rich stories. And sometimes, even later, after we grew up, we would go back and visit with them. And I remember distinctly one summer I went back to Texas for vacation to be with the family, and my brothers wanted to take a canoe trip and down the river. And so this particular river went right through my uncle's ranch. And so we told him we were going to be coming down the river, and he said, well, I'll just meet you and we'll have lunch together, we'll bring a picnic. So we were sitting there, and he told us, okay, you know, there's a bridge about a mile north of my house, and why don't you guys pull in there, and I'll be there, or I'll be there shortly. So we sat around when we got there, and we started talking to him, and it was always a joy to be with him, and he began to tell about stories. And then he looked around, and he said, you know, I think I've been here before. And he looked around, and he said, yes, I have. He said, when I was 16 years old, I brought some horses from Bandera, and they were and we came right through here, and I had a mule full of all of my gear, my food and my clothes, and we pulled up here, and as we crossed this river right here at this spot, that mule started rolling in the water and just destroyed all of my supplies. My supplies floating down the river, and I madly ran out and got them, and I needed to hang them up and dry them. So he said, I looked around, and I found an old railroad spike, and I drove it in an oak tree, and I strung my rope from there over to another tree. And then he said, I think that was just right over there. And we walked over there. There was that railroad spike in that tree. And so that was so real for us. I mean, sure, it was a story that he was embellishing it, but suddenly there was that railroad spike, and right here is where that event happened when he was 16 years old. And so his stories never stopped. And, we just loved that. And so years later, when I was in the Army, I was a drill sergeant stationed in Fort Knox, Kentucky, and the battalion sergeant major came to me and said, you're the new scoutmaster, because the current scoutmaster got orders for Vietnam. I had never been a scoutmaster, and I didn't know what to think about it or to do about it. He took me over to the scout hut, and it was an army barracks, a two-story army barracks, and he introduced me to 100 boys, all army brats, but the most respectful group of boys I've ever been around. And I became their scoutmaster, and I really loved it. And one day we got an invitation to come to the district campery, and the flyer said, there's going to be a storyteller there. And I told the boys, this is just going to be great, because you know, if you've never heard storytelling, you're going to love this. And I was so excited, and we got there, and the storyteller was terrible. I mean, it was embarrassing. Oh. And so I was embarrassed, because I had really built this guy up for my boys. And so then they wanted to know, well, tell us about storytelling. What's so great about it? And so they asked me to tell them stories. And I hadn't told stories. I had just listened to stories. But I thought everybody listened to stories. And so I thought, well, I suppose I can do that. So I started doing what my uncle did, telling stories about my childhood. But since I had Boy Scouts, I decided that the kind of stories I needed to tell were the kind of stories that centered around life lessons, things that I learned while growing up that I felt like these boys needed to learn. And so I did. I just started telling my stories to the boys. And it wasn't very long before they demanded a story at every meeting. And then it went much longer after that that the parents started coming to the meeting just to listen to the stories. And, you know, one thing led to another. And one day I discovered that people would pay to listen to my stories. And that's kind of how it got started. It was all really by accident. It wasn't by design.
Mm-hmm. When you tell stories live, what's that like with the audience, the relationship that you develop with your audience?
You know, you develop a real bond with your audience. You begin to notice, you notice the people, you notice their eyes, you notice their expressions, and you notice, you can tell when you've got them in a trance. You know, you can just tell when you've got them. I remember I did a show in Lubbock, Texas. And if I rattle on too long, tell me, cut me off. So, I did a show in Lubbock, Texas. And I had just written a piece about my father. This was a piece of a poetry, piece of cowboy poetry. And I'd written about my father, and it was about Father's Day, you know, I mean, about that time of the year. So I thought, well, I hadn't ever performed that piece before, but I think I will. And so I did it. Now, before the show, like I guess all performers do this, they peek out through the curtain and see how the audience is fitted up, you know, because you want to. And I peeked out, and this big old crusty-looking farmer came in, and he sat down on about the third row. And he had this look about him like, you are not going to impress me. You know, it was that kind of thing. And so I was already feeling like, oh, I wish that guy wasn't here. And, you know, like people just, their body language kind of expresses stuff like that.
Yeah.
And so I got through several of my pieces, and I couldn't help but notice it. I was watching this guy. And he started off very stern, very stiff, and he would slowly loosen up. And believe me, you notice that as a performer because you react to your audience. That's the bond of storytelling with the audience. What they give, you respond to. And if they give back, you respond even more. And so this guy began to respond, and I began to notice. And then I got into this particular piece about my father. And this guy started, tears just started crawling down his face.
Oh,
and I didn't really know how to deal with that. I'd never had anybody cry in my audience before, but this big old guy was just, I mean, he wasn't making any sounds, but the tears were really coming, glistening off his face. And after the show, I was backstage, and here came this guy. And he knocked on the door very timidly, and he came in. And he said, I just want you to know, he said, I haven't talked to my daddy in over 30 years, but I'm going to give him a call. And that did so much for me. It made me realize that I have a message that needs to get out in my stories.
Yeah.
And I've had many such experiences like that over the years with the reactions and interactions with the audience. But believe me, you read them like a book. If somebody thinks they're sitting there and you don't notice them, they're wrong, because you do notice them. If you've got house lights at all, you see their faces, you see their expressions, and you read their body language.
Mm-hmm.
And you respond to it.
We're going to take a very quick break, and then when we come back, we're going to move from storytelling live into storytelling in book form. And so we're going to just take a quick moment here to listen to Richard Polinelli, our good friend with Tuscany Bay Books, and we'll be right back with Joe Harrington in just a moment.
Hey everybody, Richard Polinelli with Tuscany Bay Books. And if you're a reader looking for the next best adventure for your summertime reading, or, you know, coming up on the winter, come to TuscanyBayBooks.com and check out our amazing bookshelf filled with books by some of the best authors out there in science fiction, fantasy, mystery thrillers, westerns, you name it. we've got something for you to read. And if you're an author who has just finished your manuscript and you're looking for a publisher, come to TuscanyBayBooks.com. Fill out our submission form. We'll take a look at it and we'll see if we can get you published and get you doing what you should be doing, which is writing your very next book. TuscanyBayBooks.com, that's your place to go if you're a reader or a writer. And now back to Rendezvous with a Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell.
Welcome back. We're talking with our guest, storyteller, author, and poet, Joe Harrington. Joe, you've written these two books. Takeo, I held them up a moment ago. The first one was the first in a series, Takeo, and then the newest one, which I inhaled both of these books, Takeo, the Book of Secrets. You call the genre, I thought it was interesting, Western science fiction. You want to tell us a little bit about this series?
Yeah, I call them science fiction, but in Western science fiction, because the characters are cowboys at heart, and a lot of the things that they do and where they come from are from the cowboy background and things that they learn and do there. But the Takeo series, both of the books, really started in cowboy country, but they evolved from the mysteries and the legends and the myths of those areas. As Jim mentioned, when we started this, I grew up in that exploring and having high adventure with my good buddy David Kerr, from, the Big Bend country all the way over to the Guadalupes, and we just scoured that country. I'm convinced we got into places that I don't think any white man ever had been. Only the Indians that lived there, because they were so remote and so rugged. And a lot of the Big Bend country is like that. So is the Guadalupe. Some of the most rugged country that you'll ever be in. And it's rich with mysteries. It's rich with stories that really never ended. And there were stories that fascinated me. And there's stories like that all across the Midwest. Stories that have to do with the American Indians, and stories that have to do with miners, and just a lot of mysteries. And so I can remember being at many of these places where, for example, I knew that Geronimo had been, and I would, or Victorio, and or any of those guys, and I would think, man, what would it have been like right here 200 years ago when these guys were here? And I ran across a lot of places like that, and I would feel that way when I would run across some of the Indian sites with their cooking pits or things like that. And I would start to wonder, what would it have been like to be here? And when I got into the legends and the myths and the unfinished stories, my desire was to finish those stories with my own imaginative resolution to those stories. Mm-hmm. And so both of these books are really resolutions to mysteries of those areas. For example, the first book, Takeo, was originated from the mysteries from the lights that were the Morpho lights, the ghost lights, and the legends of those go way back to the American Indians, and what they thought they were, and what everybody thought they were up until today. And it's interesting, when I wrote that book, I did my book signing in Alpine, Texas, which was just right near where the Morpho lights are always seen. And I met a scientist who was actually studying the Morpho lights, and he was writing his own book about it. But he was writing it from a scientific point of view. I, of course, was writing it from a science fiction point of view. Mm-hmm. And I had my own idea of what they might be. And for me, they were a doorway into another dimension. And the book takes you to that other dimension and the characters in that dimension, and all of the adventures that were associated with that. When that book was finished, a lot of people said, are you ever going to write a sequel to this?
Yeah.
So I thought about that for a long time. And even I even wrote the first two chapters of that book years and years ago. And then my work just got me so involved and so busy that I just put it away and never thought any more about it. And then lo and behold, when this pandemic hit, I just thought, well, why not? Why can't I just put that back out and finish it? Mm-hmm. And so I did. And I gave that story a resolution. But there again, it came, so many of the things that are in that book came from unfinished mysteries and legends that still exist today. And I just gave them an ending. For example, the second book, really the seed for that got started with Ben Sublett's lost gold mine in the gold mines. And it was always fascinating to me that people had always said gold could not originate in the Guadalupes. And I was puzzled, you know, because of the kind of land that was there, the sediment thing. And I was fascinated by that. If it was not possible for gold to originate there, how did it get there? And of course, Geronimo boasted that it was the largest deposit in the West, the largest gold deposit in the West. And I thought, man, I ought to be able to do something with that. So that's how that story got started. I decided to do something with that very concept. You know, how did that gold get there? Where did it come from? Mm-hmm. And is it still there? And then, of course, the more I'd studied about Ben Sublett, I found out that he was an interesting character. And he grew up, I mean, he didn't grow up. He moved to my hometown. And he died in my hometown. He raised three children, two girls and a boy there. His wife died there. And so, you know, all of this just fell in place. And I thought, boy, what a perfect setting and character to use as the seed for this story. So that's kind of how that happened. And then my two characters that begin in the original Tocoa show up again in the Book of Secrets and continue that adventure and give it resolution. Because the Tocoa, the first in the series, didn't have, it was written expecting a sequel to happen. And so that's why people would ask, are you ever going to do the sequel? Because it finished like, okay, this is over more. So the Book of Secrets was more. And other things fascinated me. Like I've always been fascinated by so many of the mysteries in the world, the Great Pyramids, and a lot of the things that nobody can really explain how and why they're there. Stonehenge, Colossus of Rhodes, all of those amazing places, and why and how were they built? And so I of course had an imaginative concept of that, and that's what the Book of Secrets was all about, because the Book of Secrets held the answers to all of those questions. What happened to Atlantis? Why was Atlantis even and those kinds of things. So that's why it's science fiction. It's science fact based in science fiction.
Right. Go ahead.
We were both talking about this. you kind of wove these things together, the science fiction and fact and a little legend. You bring in Nikola Tesla.
Yeah.
You know, the fellow from the 1800s who was a great electrical inventor who invented the Tesla coil. Also, I noticed he had about 700 patents. The guy was really kind of a genius, but I don't know that we all know something about that guy.
Yeah, everybody knows a little bit about him, especially because of the Tesla cars now. Everybody knows the name. But when I was a young teenager, I was fascinated by Nikola Tesla. And I read all about his experiments, and I realized, hey, he did things that people don't have answers to today. And so I began to indulge in trying to recreate some of those instruments. And when I was a young teenager, I was really interested in, even though I was a farm and ranch kid, I was really interested in electronics. And my dad would encourage that. So he allowed me to build a little shop out back in the back part of the property. And it wasn't very big. It was like 8 feet square, but I filled it full of electronics gear. And I didn't really buy any of it. I would get old television sets. My buddy and I, David Kerr, we both had this electronics fascination. And we would go to the radio shops, radio repair, TV repair shops. And we would say, do you have any stuff you want to throw away? And so they would give us stuff. And then one time we had gathered together about $40 between the two of us. And we went down because we heard that this radio repair shop was going out of business. So we bought everything they could give us for $40. And we brought that back and filled up his barn. And that really became our parts. And we did a lot of experimentation with that. So in my little shop, I built Tesla coils. I built lightning detectors. And I took old television sets and took the, in those days, television sets had, you know, a tube in them, and they had coils on the back for the horizontal and the vertical. And I would hook those up to my antennas. And when lightning would strike, it would make the little white dot on the screen blip and go to where the direction of the lightning was striking. Of course, there was no value in that other than learning how to do it. Mm-hmm. So I did a lot of that kind of stuff, and I built Tesla coils to, my main purpose for building a Tesla coil was to kill flies. it was just for fun. I took a large window screen and I put my ground wire on that, and I would take my anode, and which was charged, you know, with thousands of volts, and I would zap those flies that would land on the screen where I had put honey and stuff. And I got a lot of shocks, but a lot of knowledge out of that, and a lot of experience out of that. Mm-hmm. And I had trouble with that. I tried putting one of those lightning detectors in my little Volkswagen car. I took out the front seat, and girls wouldn't go on a date with me when I had all that equipment in there. So a friend of mine told me, well, take that stuff out. And so I did. I took it out, took the front seat out. But I had all of my wires, you know, laying all over the floor. The antenna cables came in the car. And I went to Ariane, Texas. I was dating a girl that lived down there. And so I went to get her for a date. And there was this fantastic storm coming in. So we drove up on top of a mountain because there was a radio tower on the mountain. And I knew that lightning would eventually strike. And so we went up there, and sure enough, as soon as everything started humming and the hair on her arm started raising up, and her blonde hair started, she started screaming and crying and wanting to get out of there. And I was disappointed because I wanted to stay there.
Stay there.
Inside that car, it would be okay. And then suddenly the cables on the floorboard started arcing around her feet. That was just it. It was over. I had to take her home bawling.
Oh my gosh. Well, we can hear what a storyteller you are, because I can envision everything that you're sharing. I want to get back to the books for just a quick moment though. I'm curious. Oh, yeah. Are you a pantser, or do you work off an outline, Joe?
Wait, what was that?
Well, when you're writing, do you have an outline you're working from, or are you kind of writing by the seat of your pants?
Well, it's a little of both. I don't physically write a bullet point outline, but I don't know. I guess everybody's got their own method. I might write in a different way than other people do. But I believe that in order to be a good writer, if you're gonna write a story, first you have to understand that storytelling is transformative communication. It changes people, wraps information in a desirable package that makes them want to listen. It touches the soul. It can grab your emotions and give them a shake. But your question, how do I put together my story? I believe that you have to live good stories to write good stories. Mm-hmm. So I like to tell young writers, you know, good writing and good storytelling are not necessarily synonymous. I mean, you may write very well, but that doesn't mean you're telling a good story. Mm-hmm. Perfect prose don't hold people's interest. But a good story will ignite the brain's hardwired desire for curiosity and what happens next. Mm-hmm. And the result is you have the brain's undivided attention. So for me, you start by living as much of life as you can. I mean, really experience it, the falling down, the getting up, the learning and the growing. And that alone gives you a cargo of memories to write from. Mm-hmm. And then for me, those memories just play out as vivid images, as theatrical adventures in my mind. And I just write that down. As it plays out in my mind, I write that down. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, I have a long-running concept of where I'm going to go. I mean, for example, in the Book of Secrets, more than in Tekoa itself, but in Tekoa, the Book of Secrets, there's a lot of things that happen early in the book that I come back to later, but I knew I was going to come back to them. And there's a lot of things in the second book that I went back and answered from the first book. So there is an organization there, but I knew beforehand what I was going to do. But as far as making a legitimate outline on paper and going from one to the next, I don't write like that. I really just, I create this grand adventure in my mind, and I watch it play out, and I write it down.
Okay. We're going to take another quick break. And we're going to hear a little bit about Out West Shop. And then when we come back, Joe, we want you to tell us the backstory to The Greatest Generation. And then we're going to hear it.
Okay.
Here at the Out West Shop, we're passionate about the American West, the truth and the myth. We're purveyors of fine Western goods. We scout for unique and distinctive apparel, accessories, home decor, and general merchandise that are a reflection of the Western lifestyle. We hunt for unique artisans and craftsmen who are inspired to create decorative art you can wear based on their own love for the story of the West. We round it up and bring it to you. Check out OutWestShop.com when you need anything Western.
And we're back. And we're with a master storyteller that is entertaining us with his great stories. Joe, one of my favorite stories that you tell is titled The Greatest Generation. And briefly, I'd love you to set it up for us, and then we're going to hear it. So tell us about this piece.
I would have to say people fascinate me. I often wonder who and what that person that I pass on the street might be. And when there's opportunity, I ask them. And sometimes I'm rewarded with delightful surprises. You just never know who these ordinary people are that you encounter every day. And we really miss out when we don't try to find out. I remember one time I met an old lady, and I asked her about where she came from, her childhood and stuff like that. And one thing led to another. And she told me that when she was 9 years old, she was standing in the bank with her daddy, and Pretty Boy Floyd robbed that bank. Well, her story captured me, and that's what made me realize, man, everybody's like this. Everybody's got a story, and I want to hear it. Mm-hmm. If I'm going to call myself a writer, if I'm going to be a writer, the people around me are a wonderful source of stories. And so for The Greatest Generation, I had just finished a show in Albuquerque, and I'd gone there on the train. And so I was headed home, and I was waiting in the train station there at Albuquerque. And if you've been there, it's an old place, mm-hmm. and not very many seats in there, but there was an old gentleman sitting in there, and there were a bunch of boys that were teenage boys that were just sort of pestering. They were just being annoying. And so I thought, well, I'm going to go sit down beside that guy and pretend like I know him. And maybe did. So I sat down beside him, and then we started talking. And I realized that this was one thing led to another, and I realized I had met somebody that was unlike anybody I had ever met. It was a stunning conversation that followed. I found out that he was an old rodeo cowboy, but I also found out he was a war hero, an amazing war hero. And I got on the train and I headed home, and I started thinking about all the war heroes from that greatest generation that we're just about to lose. And so I started trying to write that piece, and it began with that experience with that old man and the life that he lived and the stories that he told me. And so The Greatest Generation is that story.
Let's take a listen to The Greatest Generation.
I pulled in tired and weary, desperate to make a stop, needing just what I knew I'd find at Katie's Coffee Shop. On a stool at the end of the counter, an old man was sitting there in a denim jacket, old blue jeans, boots, and straggly hair. I made a quick assessment, had him pegged a bum. No doubt he's begging coffee and whatever else might come. Probably a no-account drifter who'd long outlived his use. Bet he'd bummed for 40 years and had some lame excuse. But his eyes were closed and restful like he's 100 miles away. A remembering look marked his face with some distant better day. I sat down slow and easy, not wanting to intrude or make a noise to spoil his thoughts and come across as rude. Now, I'd thought him old and paltry, a victim of neglect, but then I saw his buckle and leaned in with new respect. He wore a silver trophy belt, scuffed and scratched with time. Said Prescott All-Around Champion, 1949. Wow, those things don't come easy, and they sure don't fade with time. He must have been something else, young and in his prime. He stirred then and sensed my presence, and his hat fell to the floor. And there a pin marked Lucky Ford, 1944. Now, I'd been impressed, but now I stunned and stared in total awe. This old man's a legend, not the bum I thought I saw. I said, "You? Spearhead? Patton? You must have been a kid." He quipped, "I should smile. You won't believe the things I did. Fought with him in Belgium. That's how come my leg is lame." Yeah, me and old blood and guts, son, he knew me by my name. Oh, I pelted him with questions about things I'd heard and read, and it would have pleased him some to note my interest, so he grinned. Then he said I cowboyed all West Texas till that day in 41. All us cowboys rode to town, signed up is what we done. We were six best buddies, still gullible and green, but we were men in those days, sonny. Even at 17. We went to war with Patton, broke the Battle of the Bulge. I lost those pards at Ardennes in ways I can't divulge. Bastogne, across the Rhine and on to Hitler's door, we went faster, farther, deeper than any man before. Got some medals and memories, but the scars to flesh and soul still fester when nights get long. And those memories take their toll. I came back and started over. Took a wife and settled down. Ran some cattle on the home place a few miles out of town. That girl brought my life back like sunshine in summer rain. She kept my heart from festering and took away the pain. She made me what I was meant to be and gave all there was to give. But her last ride was 2 years ago. Now I've lost my will to live. I sat there quietly listening, but it was plain to see what they had done in struggle had cleared the way for me. Well, in what only seemed like minutes, an hour had slipped away, so I stood to leave and shook his hand and left so I could pay. A tattooed kid with a lip ring complained and gave me change. An old man as old as dirt and more than partly strange. He limps in here time to time, takes that same old stool. Never talks except to you. Must be a worthless fool. I said, no, kid, that man's a legend. Maybe the last you'll ever see. You do well to get to know him because he's the reason why you're free. Hear me sneered, you lying man, and looked at me askance. I said, son, when that old man was your age, he was liberating France. And that buckle you see him wearing there, it sets that man apart from the rest of all these wannabes who think they're tough and smart. There sits the greatest generation. They don't crow or brag. They wear humility as honor, but their bravery saved our flag. They quietly walk among us, crippled, old, and deaf. Their legacy is greatness, and very few are left. Soon there'll be no more to honor, and I dread that day to dawn, because they're the greatest generation, and soon they'll all be gone.
Hey, Joe, that's really a powerful story. You know, you weave a lot of things in there to the story that the fellow's telling you. And it makes you kind of wonder if you ever saw that guy again. And does he always come to the train station? Like the young man who was serving food, you know? And you think, gee, he just comes here for something to do, maybe. You know, I think you answered this a little bit earlier, but what kind of response do you often receive from a live audience?
On this piece?
A good response. The biggest response, and my brother points this out because he loves to come and sit in the audience and just watch the audience and not watch me. He said, I love to watch the people as they listen to your stories. And I notice that when I tell stories, when suddenly they're quiet and you can tell when they're listening and they're engaged. And that's the greatest response that you can get. It says, I'm paying attention. And it even affects kids that way. I remember I did a show in Jackson Hole. And there was a group of tourists came in, and the first thing one of the mothers said, which had a bunch of young kids, and I'm talking about 7 or 8 year old boys, they're really rambunctious, and they had spent the day raft riding and horseback riding and having just a blast. And she said, "Look, I'm gonna apologize up front. I can't do anything with these boys. They are wired." And I said, "Put them right down front," and she did. And she looked at me like, are you crazy? Anybody? As soon as I started, those boys, their mouths just dropped open and they didn't make a sound. They just were glued. Storytelling has that kind of power. Mm-hmm. It engages the brain and it makes your brain make imagery. And that's what your brain was designed to do, create images. And when your brain is creating images, it's happy and it's healthy. And that's what it was designed to do. And when you're doing that, the audience feels like I'm participating. I am contributing to this story because I'm making these images. They're not coming from somewhere else. They're not coming from a screen. And there's reward in that. And that reward is where the enjoyment comes in storytelling. Doing it to yourself, really.
Mm-hmm. I know that some of what you write in rhyme, but not all. So when you're performing at a festival or to an audience, how do you choose how to organize that different rhythm?
Well, first thing you got to do is know your audience. I do a lot of research on the town, what, you know, some recent events, things that are going on in the town. I try to know the people as much as possible. And I try to know the demographics of the people. So then I choose my poetry and my stories based on what I've learned about that place. And I'll generally do, for example, in a particular set, a set's generally like 20 minutes, I will do maybe three poems and a story. Mm-hmm. Because I like to mix it up, and I find the audience likes it mixed up. There's variety in that. There's highs and lows in that. Mm-hmm. And even good cowboy poetry, nobody can sit through, unless it's a real hard fan, nobody can sit through that over and over and over, you know, for six or seven poems. So I don't want to go there. I want to leave everybody with wanting more. Right, and when I mix it up, I can do that.
Do you have a word of advice for writers or poets or folks that are thinking how fun that would be to be a storyteller? Anything you'd like to share?
Get out there and make yourself a cargo of memories to write from. That's what you've got to do. You cannot be a convincing writer if you write about things you don't know anything about. And I run across a lot of writers and poets who write about things they've never done. And so you don't feel the reality. It's just not there. But when you read the work of people who have been there and done that, that comes through somehow. It's there. And you realize this is real. They've done that. There's a lot of little things. For example, when you read Elmer Kelton, a great West Texas writer, he is such a, he's unfortunately he's dead now, but he really describes his characters so well. But you realize from the way that man writes, he was a rancher in West Texas. He knew all about that job, all the intricacies in his language and the way he says and positions things. You realize he knows what he's talking about.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm looking at the clock, Joe. I can't believe it. We have like less than 3 minutes. We want to thank you so much for being with us tonight. What a pleasure. Would you please tell our listeners where they can find you, follow you, buy your books and your CDs?
Yeah. Of course, there's my website at joeharrington.com. That's Harrington with an E. So that's one place. But my books are on Barnes & Noble and also on Amazon. And there's also ebooks of both. So you can get those as well.
And they're also on bookshop.org. And when you switch and you buy from them, you help support local independent booksellers. So it's another great source for Joe's books. Okay. Really want to thank you for being with us. We want to thank the Hot Texas Swing Band for providing tonight's music. Next week, our guest is the author of Haley and the Hot Flashes, and her name is Jane Jodan Furray. She's going to be with us next week. Jim, how can people see the podcast of the show?
Outwestshop.com.
Go to Outwest Live on the toolbar and look for Rendezvous with the Writer. And also, you can get it at latalkradio.com and also on the LA Talk Radio Facebook page. And we have a quote for tonight that goes right along with what Joe was just sharing with us. It's from Stephen King's book on writing, A Memoir of the Craft, and it's really a must-have for any writer's library. And readers, you'll find it fascinating as well. And this is the quote: description begins in the writer's imagination, but should finish in the reader's.
So true.
Yeah. So on behalf of myself and
Jim, Joe, we really appreciate it. It's been wonderful having you.
It's always fun being with you.
Till we meet again next week, Our suggestion, select a title from a genre you don't normally read and read it. It may become a new favorite. Have a blessed week, and we'll see you next week.
You're listening to Rendezvous with the Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell, only on LA Talk Radio.